From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. In these tight economic times, higher education institutions are also looking to tighten their belts. State university systems are turning to tuition increases and budget cuts to get them through. In Georgia, the education budget was cut 6% at its 35 public colleges and universities just this year. Some of those schools have also increased student fees. And now, Georgia State Senator Seth Harp wants to merge two historically black colleges with nearby white-majority schools to cut costs. The plan would combine historically black Savannah State University with historically white-majority Armstrong Atlantic State University and merge historically black Albany State with the white-majority Darton College. In a moment, we're going to hear from Michael Lomax, president of the United Negro College Fund, but first, we turn to Georgia State Senator Seth Harp, who also chairs the state's Higher Education Committee. Senator Harp, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Let's begin with this. Though tough times call for tough solutions, why are you proposing this specific remedy, given that you're in a state that has some of the oldest and best known historically black colleges and universities?
Well, we are in very great financial stress. And because of that, we're having to look to all possibilities. And when you look around the state at the 34, 35 universities and colleges that we have under our regent system, we have these two historically black colleges co-located in communities with what were predominantly white schools. And these communities themselves are not very large communities. I mean, Savannah is certainly bigger than Albany, but Albany is the Albany metropolitan area is about 75,000 people, and it just simply does not make sense, because what happens is in any fundraising effort, you have a dilution of the resources of the community, which is key for the support of the school. And for a number of years, before I became a senator, I worked in as the president of a symphony orchestra, and we saw the same thing. All of the various art functions in our community were all going to the same small group of people, and they were the same people that would support your college and universities. And when you have two of them co-located in a relatively small community, you don't have you have this dilution. Now, what my proposal was, and this needs to be very clearly understood, was to merge the white schools into the historically black colleges and universities, and that the historically black colleges and universities would be thereby strengthened, and they would be the survivors.
Now, is there precedent for this?
Well, I don't know. There is a precedent, and within our technical colleges, we are merging 14 of our technical colleges right now into a smaller number, down to 7 or 6 technical colleges, and thereby eliminating duplicity in administration costs and just the president's jobs, and you go right on down the list of the various people that are primarily administrators. By cutting and doing this, then you have a reasonable process whereby you do have substantial savings.
If the economic crisis continues, as some expect that it will, into 2010, perhaps beyond, do you foresee, Senator, suggesting merging additional schools in your state?
That could very well be. We are merging right now the financial aspect of all the colleges and universities, but even that is just a small amount of money that will be saved from this process, and we need to be very aggressive about how we do it. What we want to do is those schools that remain are outstanding schools, well-funded schools, well-supported schools, who create world-class graduates for our state.
Final question is this, sir: you represent the Midland, Georgia area, as I understand it. What are your constituents saying about
this? Well, I've talked to a number of friends, both African American and white, and strong support, very strong support. And even one of my very dearest friends, who's African American, said, "This is an excellent idea. Why don't we do more of this?"
Now, you've mentioned also the desegregation argument. Is that an effective one for you in this case?
Well, that just makes sense, because when we look at how these schools were created, Savannah State was created as a de jure African-American school. It was a school for black students to go to school. This was created around shortly after the turn of the century. So, I mean, that is a legally created black school. Brown v. Board of Education, and the law clearly says we don't have separate but equal. That is gone. That's 54 years ago. Brown v. Board was enunciated. All of our public schools in Georgia are integrated schools, but the idea of having a black separate but equal school, I mean, that's dead. That Brown v. Board of Education overruled that philosophy. The Darton Albany State situation was a de facto situation. That school was created. Darton was created in 1963. I lived in the Albany, Georgia area in 68, 69. And I have no doubt in my mind that school was created as a means of continuing and perpetuating segregation.
All right. Well, Senator, we're going to have to end it there because of what we want to give opportunity for the next person to come on and speak with us. I appreciate your appearing on News and Notes.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
That was Seth Harp, a Georgia State Senator who chairs the state's Higher Education Committee. And now we're going to continue this conversation with Michael Lomax. He's taught at Morehouse and Spelman Colleges and served as president of Dillard University in New Orleans. And since 2004, he's been the head of the United Negro College Fund. Michael, thank you for coming on.
Great to be with you.
You've been quoted as saying that the proposal put forth by Senator Harp is, quote, not thoughtful or timely. Why do you say that?
Well, I'm deeply concerned any time you single out special mission institutions for merger and possible elimination to solve a financial problem, and it's a solution which is proposed without any kind of study or examination or thoughtful analysis. You know, he has said we've got a problem financially, so let's merge these two sets of institutions. It's at the same time, by the way, that the university system is expanding and opening new institutions. So I'm not sure that this is the only way of resolving the financial challenge.
Did you not have a situation similar to this with regard to Tennessee State University and the University of Tennessee, Nashville, some years back? If you are familiar with that, can you tell us what happened and how
that
has worked?
Well, I mean, that was a 40-year-old case, I think 1968. The ruling ultimately was that the University of Tennessee at Nashville, which was created long after the Tennessee State University, the historically black college, was in place, that it had to merge into Tennessee State University, and that the older historically black institution would survive. You know, one point that I'd like to make is that although these public institutions, Tennessee State, Albany State, and Savannah State, were created for blacks because they weren't permitted to go to the other public institutions, these institutions have never been segregated institutions. They've always had white faculty. They've always had white administrators. And their doors have, when it's legally been permissible, been open to white students. And, you know, what we haven't changed is the attitudes of the communities in which they exist, that these are great places for any student to go and get an education.
Would you rather see a black institution like Morris Brown in Atlanta close its doors for financial reasons than merge with a white institution that might keep it going?
Well, my view is that historically black colleges are viable institutions. You know, some of them can go out of business, just like majority institutions can go out of business, but that they're viable institutions and that they provide an incredible educational opportunity for the student to attend them, and that their doors are open to any student who wishes to come. If you go and visit Xavier University in New Orleans with its incredible pharmacy program, you're going to see Asian kids, white kids, and African-American kids studying together and getting a great education. And I believe in Albany, students who are at the white two-year community, largely white two-year community college, ought to be looking at articulating over to Albany State and getting a four-year degree, because Georgia and the nation need more students with bachelor's degrees.
Final thing, though, is this. The economic crisis is continuing, and as I asked the senator, do you think that it will be a foreboding for some difficulties for particularly the black colleges?
Well, I don't think it's, I mean, I think it's going to be difficult for all under-resourced institutions, but the fact is that in the 21st century, with more kids of color in the pipeline, graduating from high school and needing to go on to college and needing to get degrees, this nation is going to need more colleges to fill all of their seats and provide opportunities for all these kids to get degrees. It will need historically black colleges. It will need historically Catholic colleges. It will need a whole range of institutions, public and private, if we're going to meet the human capital needs of our nation in the 21st century.
I've got about 15 seconds for this answer. What you said, notwithstanding, you survive in a large part, do you not, on contributions, and are contributions for the HBCUs and the United Negro College Fund down, as I would imagine they might be?
Well, you know, we're watching this economic crisis like anyone. Our goal this year is $97.8 million in our annual campaign at UNCF, and we're going to close our books on March 31st, I hope very close to $97.8 million.
All right, Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Michael Lomax. He is the president of the United Negro College Fund. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Social psychologists have found that people unknowingly hold stereotypical views about other social groups. But does that mean that we're hardwired to harbor racial biases? And can racial prejudice be unlearned? Researchers have studied racism in laboratories all around the globe to answer those questions. In today's installment of our series on race, we'll explore the science of racism with John DeVideo, a professor of psychology at Yale University, and Keith Payne, assistant professor of psychology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Gentlemen, welcome to News and Notes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
John, let me begin with you. Are we programmed to hold stereotypical beliefs and attitudes about other social groups?
We're programmed to see other people in terms of their group membership and the group categories, because the world is so complex that we can't treat everybody as an individual and something brand new. So we have some basic needs to simplify the world, and stereotyping is based on group membership is one of those ways that we fundamentally do that.
Maybe we should, before we go forward, Keith, define some terms here. Racism, since that's something we're going to be talking about quite a bit during our conversation today. What exactly is it? If I see a white person on the street and I say, oh, I don't like that person because they're white, is that a racist reaction because of the way I've just described it?
Well, most psychologists would say that that kind of dislike reaction, we would call that a prejudice. That's a negative reaction to somebody based on the group that they belong to. You could go further. A stronger version of that dislike might be called racism, because it's not just based on group membership, but based on some idea of some biologically essential version of race. But prejudice is what social psychologists often focus on when they're talking about simply a dislike of somebody because of their group membership.
So, John, if I were to say the converse of that, that Asian people are smart, or they're good at math, or they're good at science, or they're good at engineering, is that racism also in reverse?
Well, I'm going to be like Keith there and say that it's not so much racism but stereotyping.
Mm-hmm.
Because what you're doing is you're associating certain qualities or characteristics to the group. But even though they may be positive characteristics, you're denying the individuality and differences that occur in that group and pigeonholing them in a certain way. So that would be stereotyping.
All right. Now, much of the research around the science of racism revolves around implicit and explicit racial bias. And we're going to be referring to both explicit and implicit bias throughout this interview. Keith, explain the difference between them, will you?
Right. Well, explicit racial bias is what you get when you use when you ask somebody to report what their attitudes are. So if you ask people, what do you think about white people? What do you think about black people? And you give them a questionnaire measure, for example, and measure how favorable or unfavorable their attitudes are, that's explicit prejudice or explicit attitudes, because you're asking people to reflect on their beliefs and directly express them to you. Now, implicit bias or implicit prejudice is something that happens more automatically or spontaneously when thoughts or feelings occur to somebody. They may not reflect on them, and they may not report them to you on a questionnaire whenever you ask them to reflect about them. But nonetheless, using various laboratory techniques, we can measure people's spontaneous reactions in a way that tells us something about their racial attitudes, even though they wouldn't report it explicitly.
So, John, is one more common than the other? One bias more common than the other?
Well, what we found is that the explicit attitudes, which are the ones that you self-report, you talk about, you know you have, they're conscious, have become much less biased and negative over time, you know, particularly since the civil rights legislation. However, the implicit biases seem to be much stronger. So we find that in our subjects, about 80% of whites say they're not prejudiced explicitly, but about 60 to 70% of them have these negative implicit biases.
Now, that was the study that you did in 2002, wasn't it?
Well, that's one of the studies leading up to that 2002 study.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment, because you measured explicit and implicit racial attitudes among 40 white college students in 2002, and the results showed that there were some big differences in the way that black and white participants perceived their interactions. Explain it to us as simply as you can.
Okay. There were some fundamental differences, but the way you can think about this is that whites, when they're interacting with a person of color, have access to their conscious attitudes and try to control their behavior to mirror those conscious attitudes. And that's typically our verbal behavior, which we can control. So what we found was the people who most whites have these positive explicit attitudes and the negative implicit attitudes. And that means most whites were able to control their verbal behavior in a very positive way towards a black person. The implicit attitudes, which are much more spontaneously expressed, as Keith mentioned, often gets translated into our nonverbal behaviors. And therefore, our nonverbal behaviors of whites in these interactions tend to be negative. Here's the problem, as simply as I can state it. Because whites have access only to their conscious and controllable and behaviors that they can easily monitor, like their verbal behaviors, they would think that everything was going wonderfully in that interaction, that they thought they were behaving in a good, non-prejudiced way. Blacks in that same interaction don't have access to whites' explicit or implicit attitudes. All they have access to is our behaviors.
Now, why is that? Let me stop you to ask. Why do you say that?
Well, because our attitudes are feelings about a member of another group. And we can't read other people's minds about what people are thinking and feeling. So we base our impressions on somebody else, not so much on their intentions, because we don't know their intentions. We base it on what they do.
Now, I want to make sure that I'm clear with this.
Sure.
Am I understanding you to say that white people have an ability to see or sense how we feel as blacks, but we don't have that same ability to sense how they may be feeling?
I would say it the other way around. I would say that whites tend to judge the way things are going based on whites' own impressions, whites' own intentions of what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Because of that, they would focus mainly on themselves and their feelings and the behaviors that they're engaging in that are easily monitorable, like their verbal behavior. What they don't base it on is the implicit attitudes, which they don't know they have, or their nonverbal behavior, which they don't know that they're emitting. The black person, on the other hand, in these interactions, hears the white person say positive things, but sees nonverbal behaviors that indicate anxiety or even dislike towards them. And what we find is where the whites base their impressions on how things are going on the verbal behavior that's positive, blacks dismiss the verbal behavior and focus on the negative nonverbal behaviors that are related to the negative implicit attitudes.
Keith, let me bring you back in and ask you this, because this is one of those kinds of conversations that takes place all the time in bars, in kitchens, in psychology courses across America. But how can you actually legitimately, realistically quantify and measure these kinds of attitudes in a way that is accurate and can be used as a source of as a resource for figuring out how to make the 2, 3, 4 races, whatever you want to say, come together?
Well, there's a lot of research that goes on in psychology labs and other kinds of labs aimed at answering exactly that question. How can we measure these things in a way that we can quantify them and make sure that they're accurate and valid? And a number of different tests have been developed. Most of these are computer-based tests in which you present the test takers with pictures or words of various kinds presented on the computer screen and measure their reactions in various ways, be that whether they say something is pleasant or unpleasant, or looking at their reaction times to respond to those items on the computer screen. And then we validate those by seeing whether they predict people's behavior. And I can tell you more about the details if you want.
Well, I'm going to ask you to do that. In fact, I'm going to make reference to one of the studies that you did. But first, let me tell our audience that you are listening to NPR's News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox, sitting in for Farai Tudeha. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the science of racism. And we are talking about it with John DeVideo, professor of psychology at Yale University, and Keith Payne, assistant professor of psychology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Keith, let's talk about Barack Obama for a moment. His bid for the White House really forced Americans to confront their attitudes towards race. And your lab conducted a study on President-elect Obama's likelihood for success in the campaign. As I understand it, your findings were that he was likely to lose by 6 percentage points, not lose, but lose 6 percentage points based on race alone. Now, did that happen, and how are you able to determine if, in fact, that did happen?
Right. Well, obviously, there's only one election, and so only one outcome actually happened, right? And we know the results of that outcome were that President-elect Obama won in the end by a margin of about 6% in the popular vote. What this study showed was that, first of all, there if you measure people's explicit and implicit prejudice, both predicted willingness or unwillingness to vote for Obama. So people who were higher in prejudice, both on explicit measures and on implicit measures, said they were less willing to vote for Obama, and this was done several weeks prior to the actual election. Now, what you can do with a statistical simulation using those findings is estimate if prejudice were at zero, how many people would be voting for Obama, and how many people, given whatever level of prejudice they have on those tests, say they're willing to vote for Obama. And the statistical models predict that had prejudice not existed, had it been at zero, Obama would have won by an additional 6 points more than he did. So it's not the case that the study predicted that Obama would lose by 6 points, simply that the amount of prejudice that is out there in American society may have cost him up to 6 points beyond what vote he actually
that he actually got. So, John, let me ask you this: can racial biases be unlearned?
The way to think about this is that, particularly these implicit biases, are habits of mind. They're things that have been associated with race all your life, and in our society, which historically has had racist traditions and is characterized by racial disparities, we develop these automatic associations with people of color that are more negative than the associations with whites. So they become habitual ways of thinking, and they're like habits. What you have to do to get rid of a habit is to, first of all, be aware that you have the habit. That's why it becomes really important to make people aware that these negative implicit attitudes exist, because if we don't know we have them, we're not going to work to get rid of them.
I'd like to follow that with this. We are in a multicultural society in America, and in fact, our show is going to be doing a series on that very soon. Is using whites and blacks as the models for this kind of study. Is it relevant in a multicultural society, Keith?
Well, I think studying attitudes toward blacks and whites is continually relevant in America because of our history in which the white-black divide has been obviously very central. But studies really aren't limited only to studying whites and blacks, and I think they are moving more and more in that direction toward measuring attitudes toward many different ethnic groups.
Are you finding in the studies that have been done so far that there are any notable or significant differences in the attitudes of blacks or whites or Asians or Latinos?
Well, in general, there's a tendency toward each ethnic group to have the most favorable reactions to its own group and less favorable reactions to anybody who's not their own group. And so one way to think about it is that it's not about whites' attitudes per se or blacks' attitudes themselves. It's about how people define themselves in terms of who's in my group and who's not.
I'd like to go back to Obama for a moment, if I might, John, and it's this. There's been a lot written and said about his presidency being a bellwether in terms of changing racial attitudes in America. Is there anything to suggest from the empirical evidence that you have, although it's early, that this is already the case?
Well, I think, let me say this. It's going to be complicated because remember that whites tend to operate on the basis of sort of the most obvious or explicit kinds of demonstrations. And one of the dangers of this is that I think many whites are declaring Obama's election as the end of racism in America. And they see it as indicative that race is no longer a problem. And as Keith mentioned, the fact that he won doesn't mean that racism doesn't exist, because it could have reduced the number of people who voted for him. In the long run, though, you know, if we can understand that racism still exists and that we still need to be better as individuals and as a society, the kind of symbolic contact we're going to have with Barack Obama repeatedly, remember we talked about this as positive associations are the basis of these implicit attitudes, that if we can continue to associate positive things with blacks, that can help overwrite and override some of the negative prejudices that people have into the future.
I've got about 30 seconds for you, Keith, for the last answer. I'm assuming that having a person like Barack Obama, who is multiracial, multicultural, in the White House provides a wonderful laboratory for you and the work that you are studying.
That's right. I mean, it provides a way to get outside the laboratory, too, and look at how the things that we study in the laboratory tell us about decisions out there in the world, like voting decisions, like public opinion. And I just to follow on what John was saying, the research does show that having positive role models is one way to change the associations that people have, and it's very well possible that President Obama could serve as that positive role model.
All right, gentlemen, thank you both very much. Very interesting information.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was John DeVideo, a professor of psychology at Yale University, and Keith Payne, an assistant professor of psychology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. This week in our Sports Bloggers Roundtable, we spotlight two rogue athletes in the Empire State and one Rhodes Scholar in the Sunshine State, plus our annual look at the BCS mess. We've got Chad Brown. He writes for Alpha Blog Sports, and D. Will, who writes for the blog Sports On My Mind. Hey, fellas.
How you doing, Tony?
Doing great. How are you guys doing?
Doing well. How you doing?
All right, let's start with Plaxico Burress, who's not doing so well, I would imagine. By now, football fans know that last Friday, the New York Giants wide receiver was partying at a Manhattan night spot when he accidentally shot himself in the thigh with a .40-caliber semi-automatic pistol. He was suspended without pay for the rest of the season and the playoffs, but it gets worse. He was then charged with illegal weapons possession. That could get him 3.5 to 15 years in prison. But it gets worse. The doctor who treated him at the hospital under he came in under an assumed name, did not report it to the police, and now everybody's pointing fingers at everyone. This is just a mess, Chad Brown.
Yeah, there's no other way to describe it. It is a mess. You keep reading more and more about it. Now Pierce is going to have to testify before the grand jury. We're learning last night that the Giants trainer told them where to take him. And it's just, it's mind-boggling. When someone told me about it on Saturday, I thought they were joking. I mean, he shot himself in the leg. What does that mean? No, he really shot himself in the leg. And just more details that come out, like even the people at the club are going to turn him away, but they let him in regardless. It's just mystifying. Why are you going to put yourself in the situation? You can't stop people from going out, but why are you going to put yourself in the situation, carry a gun illegally, not tell your teammates about them? It's fortunate no one else was hurt, but nobody is clean in this. And I think we've got more to come on this.
Isn't this the guy that 6 months ago signed a $35 million new contract?
It sure is, and that's the unfortunate thing, or part of the unfortunate thing for Plexico Burress, is that he was a hero 6 months ago, and now he may never play another down in the NFL. And so it's kind of a hero to tragedy, cautionary tale and all of that stuff. So the one thing I wonder is, will we ever find out what truly was the story here? Was it just Plexico Burress, or was Antonio Pierce involved in some way more than we think? He did try to hide the gun, after all. Was he doing that as a friend, or was he doing that because perhaps his prints were on the gun? We'll never know now.
Yeah, well, you'll have to sit in the grand jury because Pierce is going to be testifying there.
That's right.
I just cannot imagine that Roger Goodell's got another situation where a team has got to be looked at in terms of how they handle or try to sweep things under the rug. But never mind. Never mind.
Okay.
Let's move on to a different problem that Roger Goodell has. This involves suspensions of 6 players, 4 games without pay for violating the league's anti-doping policy. Now, they each tested positive for a diuretic, which supposedly can mask steroid use, and it does other things also if you're trying to, make weight, things of that sort. Some of the players from the Minnesota Vikings have already gone to a judge who has granted an injunction so that they can at least play on this coming weekend against Detroit. And some of the other players, the NFL Players Association, is coming to their defense. So, Chad Brown, how do we sort this out for us?
I'll do my best. My understanding is that all these players did not know about the illegal element, or that they were, that none of them were trying to cover up anything, that they were all trying to lose weight. And I mean, it's devastating for, if you're the Minnesota Vikings, that's the heart and soul of your defense. I mean, forget about it. If with the New Orleans Saints, you lose a Deuce McAllister, who is already being phased out. Another player, Grady Jackson, has an appeal and was not suspended, so it's very much up in the air with what's going to happen here. It really seems like this was incidental, that none of these players is trying to hide anything, but Goodell's going to act. Goodell can be very swift in most cases, somewhat lenient on others, but I really don't know what to make of it at this point, other than that the Williams brothers are evidently going to be on the field against Detroit this Sunday.
Well, D. Will, it seems is that the league has a very clear policy that says you are responsible for any substance that you put into your own body. Now, while
right.
It's saying that on one side of their mouths, on the other side, they have a situation, apparently in this case, I want you to speak to it, that the league or some folks within the league front office knew that there was a potential for this substance to be included in the stuff that these guys took, but nobody passed that warning along to the players.
Yes, I find that incredibly odd, that they did have knowledge of the substance potentially being in the supplements, and not, as you said, not passing this along to the players. Now it happens that the players test dirty, and who's at fault? Oh, it's the players. Okay, and of course the NFL takes no responsibility at all, per usual. I do think it's odd. I don't know, again, if we'll ever find out how this really occurred or not, unless the NFLPA does really get involved. And they actually, over time, have proven to take player sides to a point, but not want to rankle the owners and the commissioner too much at the same time. So, once again, we're in those murky waters of will we ever know the truth? As someone said today, a reporter said today, if they had managed to keep this quiet, no one would ever have known and these guys wouldn't have been suspended. So there's another element of craziness to this whole scene.
God, Roger Goodell is one thing after another that the guy has to deal with, but that's what they're paying him to be the commissioner for. So
that's
his job.
That's what he gets the big bucks for.
All right,
let's
talk about football on another level, the people that play on Saturday and the BCS. Almost like, you know, the BCS is almost like Christmas music when it comes to the bowl series because we're singing the same old song at the same time of year every year. And here we go again. Worthy teams being left out in a way that for some people doesn't make any sense. And I'm particularly talking about Oklahoma and Texas. Now, Texas beat Oklahoma. And even though each team has an identical 11-1 record, the BCS put Texas behind Oklahoma. Alabama, no argument there, number one. How are they going to straighten this out, Chad?
I don't know how they're going to straighten it out. All I know is that it seems like the SEC championship game between Alabama and Florida, people are already dubbing that as being the real national championship game. But Texas got robbed. There's no other way to put it. It seems like there's some pole positioning going on here because Texas beat Oklahoma, but lost to Texas Tech, who then got stomped by Oklahoma. So I don't know which head-to-head system works here. I don't think the BCS even knows. It's like they put all the names in a hat and just picked one out.
Well, wasn't Texas, D. Will, a beneficiary of this very same kind of BCS shenanigans a couple of years ago?
Yes, they were. You know, and being down here in Texas, they're making a big case for themselves and continue to, as does Texas Tech, because of course, as Chad said, they beat Texas. The problem with the BCS computer is that the computer can't see teams play, and that therein lies the problem with the computer. Texas defeated Oklahoma. And they held Oklahoma to 35 points. No team has done that since. Oklahoma's averaged 60 points a game since then. Also, the main thing about Texas is that they were 1 second away from running a four-game gauntlet of playing undefeated top 10 teams. It's so late in the season that no team ever in the history of the NCAA would have done that, would have accomplished that feat. They were 1 second away, and they got no credit for that. And that's probably the horror of all of this.
So what happens, guys, if Florida beats Alabama this weekend to the BCS thing?
We go Florida, Oklahoma, apparently, you know, which leaves out Texas and perhaps the best defense in the history of the NCAA, USC.
Well, I agree with D. Will on that, especially leaving USC out of the mix is also a head scratcher.
Well, you know, there's a columnist here in Los Angeles who wrote in the LA Times today that he thought that Utah deserved to go to the BCS over USC because they're what, undefeated?
Well, so is Boise State. So,
yes.
Yes.
Thank you.
Point well made. Point well taken.
Point well made.
All right. Let's go back to the Big Apple, Chad Brown, where you guys always have drama. I love
yes,
New York
do.
City, but it's just drama, sports, and drama, and more sports. And this sport drama involves none other than Stephon Marbury of the New York Knicks, sort of the New York Knicks. It looks like he was ordered to stay away from his team while the organization tries to come to some kind of an agreement to get him out of town. This is only the latest episode, of course, in the Marbury drama that has just gone on and on ever since he came to the team 4 years ago. So is he on the team, not on the team? Is he in the building, not on the building? Do they like him, hate him? What do you guys want?
I think we just want a resolution to all of this. And while Stephon is no choir boy whatsoever, the Knicks had to have seen this coming. And I understand there are salary implications, there are roster implications, but find a way to get rid of him before the season begins. I know it's easy for me to say that standing on the sidelines, but having said that, I'm trying to think of a memorable moment that Stephon has had or a coach that he hasn't clashed with since he's been here. I mean, there's no denying his talent, but But he's going around saying that his side of the story isn't heard. I feel like I've heard this before. It's just a broken record. They had a 15-minute meeting. They decided that they're going to have to agree to disagree about. The only thing they can agree is they'll give them 21.9 million to stay in street clothes and just stay away. The Knicks are trying to rebuild. They're off to a decent start, although you have to wonder if they could have come to some agreement with Marbury one way or another, we wouldn't have all this talk maybe about scrapping the next couple seasons and waiting for LeBron, but that's another story.
Another story altogether. But, D. Will, I guess part of the problem is Marbury's contract and who would want to pick it up and whether the Knicks would give him away the way the Grizzlies gave the Lakers Paul Gasol last year.
Right, yeah, I don't think that's happening at all. I think actually James Dolan wants to make Stephon Marbury's life as difficult as possible, his post-New York Knicks life. They did offer him a buyout, which was $3 million less than he wanted. Marbury wanted to take $1 million off his contract. The Knicks wanted $3 million off the contract. Stephon walked out of the meeting. Okay, so he self-inflated his value again. The thing I can say for Steph is that he's a great philanthropist, but unfortunately that's not helping him on the basketball court.
Well, listen, we are not going to end our sports bloggers roundtable on doping and people that don't want to play and people that shoot themselves at nightclubs. Okay,
thank
we're going
goodness.
To talk about a young man from Florida by the name of Myron Roll. He's probably the smartest athlete in college football, a sophomore. He is also a Rhodes Scholar, and he is going to forsake going into the NFL to go to Oxford, England. Now, that's a positive story, is it not, Chad?
I think it's a great story, and I think – and what I really think is wonderful is how everybody in the FSU family, on the team, the coaches, the athletic department, has really rallied around him. But I think it's a great decision. I think it's a great decision. And if he decided to go the other way, I still think we would have to give him the benefit of the doubt. But this is just – it's wonderful to see a student athlete embrace the student aspect of it as well. And I wish him all the best.
You know, he has, D. Will. I've got 10 seconds for you to respond to this because I don't know if you've ever seen this in your lifetime or not. 3.75 GPA pre-med.
That's amazing. The only other Rhodes Scholar that we could talk about would have been Chad Pennington, but he went professional as far as football is concerned. Myron Roll is a role model. He is a student athlete instead of an athlete student. That's great to see.
Absolutely. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Enjoyed having you on.
Thank you, Tony.
Thank you, Tony.
Chad Brown writes about sports at alphablogsports.blogspot.com. Joined us from our New York studios. And D. Will writes for the blog Sports on My Mind. And now it's letter time. Our editor, Sasha Woodruff, is here with me. Hey, Sasha.
Hey, Tony. It's good to have you back in the studio. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much. I understand we got some letters about an interview we did with a man who was struggling to look for work, James Smith.
That's right. Rachel Carpenter in Philadelphia sent us these thoughts about the interview. It was very moving to hear the struggle, honesty, perseverance in that man's voice, as well as the strength. I am sure I'm not the only listener who hopes Jim Smith knows the value of those qualities.
Now, Drew, too, that's T-O-O, in Georgia, wrote us this after he heard the interview. I wanted to say how heart-wrenching I found the interview with James Smith and how deeply it moved me. I am in a similar situation for not so different reasons. It is disturbing that someone who has served his country is having to consider leaving it just to put food in his mouth. His actual criminal background is preventing employers from giving him an opportunity to make amends for his past criminal activity. My heart goes out to Mr. Smith and to the millions of other newly or soon to be newly unemployed people in this country.
Then we got some comments about a bloggers' roundtable discussion about the Canadian Supreme Court ruling that says Canadian Airlines must offer an extra seat to obese passengers. Diet Priye Cuckoo Siemens in New Delhi wrote us this. While I agree that all passengers have the right to comfortable seating, I disagree that overweight flyers should be offered a free second seat. The reality is that seats and legroom in cattle class have been shrinking for years, as have an array of services like snacks, blankets, and luggage allowance. Consumer rights have eroded, and we could all use a decent seat on the plane.
And Stacy Michael sent us this. My husband and I found ourselves agreeing with all the commentators, but wishing someone would offer a creative solution. Comfort is all very well for the obese passenger, but what about the slender one crammed into the corner of the seat next to him or her?
And finally, Valerie Evans in Novato, California, wrote in after she heard the interview we did with Republican Michael Steele about wanting to lead the Republican National Committee. She wrote, "I caught the Michael Steele interview the other night. What a refreshing voice for the Republican Party. Had Steele run against Obama, I would have had a hard time choosing. As an African American who was a closet Republican, I became disillusioned with the party during the first Bush administration. It was easy the second time around to switch parties." And that's it for letters. Thanks for writing, and please keep your comments coming.
Now NPR has a new way to chime in on our stories. Go to our program page at nprnewsandnotes.org and click on a segment. There you can click on the comments link and write us your thoughts.
And you can still send us your gripes and praises by logging on to npr.org and clicking on Contact Us. Be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name.
Thanks, Sasha.
No problem.
That's our show for today. Thanks for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to the podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for the newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, is America really a melting pot of cultures, or do differences keep us apart? We'll kick off our month-long series on the state of multiculturalism in the U.S.